This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Edward P. Jones' new novel, The Known World, is about a little-explored piece of history. In the antebellum South, some former black slaves chose to become slave owners themselves. This fact drives Jones' sprawling narrative, set in an imaginary place, Manchester County, Virginia, in 1840. New York Times reviewer Janet Maslin says of the book, "With its hard realities and prescient dreams, with its eloquent restraint and simplicity, The Known World penetrates a realm of contradictions and takes the measure of slavery's punishments." Jones is the author of a book of short stories, Lost in the City, which won a Penn Hemingway Award. It's set in the tough neighborhoods he grew up in Washington, D.C. Jones was the first member of his family to go to college. Despite the success of his first book in 1992, he still struggled to make a living until he landed a day job 19 years ago as a proofreader and writer for a tax newsletter, which he kept until very recently. The Known World is a finalist for the National Book Award. We begin with a reading. I asked Jones to introduce it.
This is the morning after Henry Townsend, the master, black man of 31 slaves, has died. His widow's maid, Loretta, has come down and told Moses, the overseer, to go and tell all the slaves on the plantation that Henry Townsend has died. Their world had changed, but they could not yet understand how. A black man had owned them, a strange thing for many in that world, and now that he was dead, maybe a white man would buy them, which was not as strange. No matter what, though, the sun would come up on them tomorrow, followed by the moon, and dogs would chase their own tails, and the sky would remain just out of reach. "I didn't sleep well," one man across the lane from Elias said to his next-door neighbor. "Well, I know I sure did," the neighbor said. "I slept like they was paying me to. Slept enough for three white women without a care in the world." "Well," the first man said, "sounds like you got a hold of some of my sleep. Better give it back. Better give it back before you wear out my sleep using it. Give it back." "Oh, I will," the neighbor said, laughing, inspecting loose threads on his overalls. "I sure will, soon as I'm finished. Meantime, I'm going to use it again tonight. Come for it in the morning." They both laughed.
Edward B. Jones, reading from his book, The Known World. I love the dialogue in that passage. Is that what you hear when you're thinking about a book, when you're planning a book? Do you hear
parts of it? Yes, in that particular episode, I wanted to inject some humor. My sense is that black people have a great deal of humor, and I'm sure it didn't just happen overnight. It happened in the 20th century. It certainly began way back there when, and I wanted to just inject some of that right there.
Well, your book is about many things, but it does cover a side of slavery that's very little known. When did you first learn that at one time blacks owned other blacks as slaves?
I was in college, I don't know if it was a footnote or a professor said something in passing. I know I didn't read some book or something that was completely about that subject. It was just some small thing that I came across. I wasn't intending on being a writer at that time. I just sort of filed the fact away. It was a big fact for me, a big surprise. I just filed it away, and in the year or so before I completed my first book, I started going through a file cabinet in my head, thinking what I would do next, and that one fact about black slave owners came to the forefront, and I began creating a world around that fact.
What kind of information did you draw on to write the book? Did you do some research?
Well, I had about 40 or so books that I was prepared to start reading in 1992 after I had finished the first book. So over those years, before I sat down in 2001 to start writing, I would read a chapter or two of this book or that book. I never finished any of the books, and by the time I got to 2001, I had read maybe 150 pages, and I had taken notes on all those pages. And I sat down at that time, 2001, and I had already worked out the novel in my head. You know, I just didn't have all those facts from those books. I had all those people that I had created. I had this place, this imaginary place, Manchester County. And so I was just ready to start the research. I had 5 weeks of vacation with this day job. And In those few days after Christmas, I looked at all those books on the shelves and looked at the notes that I had, and I knew that I didn't want to tackle any of that stuff. I knew that what I had created in my head, I was ready for. I had about 12 pages of hard copy of the novel that I had written over the years, and that was it. So I was, I felt I was ready. I felt I knew enough about the world of slavery to forge ahead.
Well, the book follows the stories of many free men and women and slaves. And in particular, it tells parallel stories of two slave owners, the white master, William Robbins, and his slave and former groom, Henry Townsend. And Townsend's parents had bought their freedom from Robbins,
yes.
And eventually they bought Henry's freedom also, but he
right.
chose to follow the path of Robbins and to buy and maintain slaves of his own. So what interested you about setting up these two parallel paths, life paths, and these two characters? One's a mentor, and one is a son who betrays his own family, really.
I think that once I got into writing about Henry Townsend, I had to find some vehicle that would allow the reader to see how he got into being a slave owner. William Robbins originally was a very, very minor character. He didn't have anything to do much beyond, I suppose, the first 50 or 60 pages originally in my head. And then I began to understand that, Henry had all those years without his father, and then, of course, without his mother. And the main guidance in his life simply was William Robbins. He was his groom. He got up every morning and waited for his master to come if his master was away. As Henry became better and better at making shoes and boots, William Robbins took him along sometimes. So in a certain sense, he became his father.
And, he didn't have his mother and father in his life because they had bought their freedom and they were working.
They had bought their freedom,
They were working to buy his freedom.
Exactly. And I say, too, that... Robbins began to see what a product he had in Henry Townsend, and he kept upping the price so that if Henry's parents had thought that in the second or third year they would have their son's freedom, well, it became the fourth or fifth year.
So
and all that time, of course, William Robbins is guiding him.
So in that sense, it's the disintegration of the family that,
yes,
that slavery
yeah,
brought
absolutely.
About, which,
yes,
which
yeah.
engenders this whole... This
yes,
whole world
yeah.
and upholding this institution.
Yeah, yeah. Despite all the parents' work to overcome that.
It's interesting in that you examine how blacks could enslave other blacks through a number of different characters. Did your thinking about this grow or evolve while you were thinking over this period of 10 years about this imaginary world?
Yeah. Huh. I often say now that I wish I had taken notes along the way, because then maybe I could have had a look at how everything developed over the years. I think that the thing of thinking it all through sort of gave me a way of knowing how everything was supposed to go, supposed to turn out. I don't know. I don't know about the evolution of my thought. I only know that I sort of went from first line of the first chapter all the way through. And so I had worked it all out in my head, you know, by the time I sat down and did the physical work. And I tried to look for all the pitfalls. I tried to make sure that all the logic was there. I tried to make sure that the major characters were fully developed. I couldn't say that, in 94 or 95, this is essentially what I was doing, because it was all those years. I mean, sometimes I would be on the subway in Washington or something, and an idea would come to me, and I never took notes.
Why not?
I just would sort of file it away, you know, they're in my brain, and so it worked it all out.
Why wouldn't you take notes?
I don't know. I think there was something about me that said, all right, you know, you don't have any right to do any writing, really, until you read all those books. Now, those 12 pages I mentioned that I had at the end of the day when I started working, I think that there was times when I really, really was anxious, you know, that the opening lines in the first chapter. I really wanted to start writing about Moses, and I really wanted to talk about Henry on his deathbed, so I couldn't hold back. And the same thing probably happened with those 6 pages of the final chapter. I really saw the sheriff get up with his toothache, and I really wanted to get at it. And I didn't allow myself any more than that. because those were all the pages I had.
So you just had, you had these two scenes that were burning a hole in your brain that you had to get down.
Well, there were a whole lot more. But I, you know, I knew I couldn't get to them until I got those pages of the, those books. And I think as the years went on, I just there was this distance that grew between me and reading all those books, you know. And I think that happened as the world became, the world of Manchester County became more and more whole.
So what finally got you over the fact that you were being held back by not having read those books?
Well, I had 5 weeks of vacation with the day job that I had. And, you know, there had been vacation time before, and I, you know, would probably just put off the reading the books and everything. And so finally, that few days after Christmas in 2001, I said, okay, yeah, 5 weeks. You're really, really going to make, you know, inroads into it. And it was really a quick decision, knowing that I was never going to read the books, and I was never going to go back to reading the notes of those 150 pages. I remember that I first started in writing a story. I had some stories in my head as well. And then I said, well, no, let's just get to the novel. As it happened, about 2 weeks into that five-week vacation, they called me from this day job that I had. I was 1 month shy of being there 19 years, and they called and told me that I didn't have a job anymore. So I think I was probably 75, 80 pages into the novel by then. So I was going at a pretty good clip. And I just got up the next day. It was Tuesday when they called me, and I got up the next day, Wednesday, and did my five pages or so, and I went on. I think that there was a certain momentum by that time, and even the general depression that would have set in if I hadn't been writing didn't come about, you know. And I think I credit that my decision somewhere, something told me to get started for some reason. I didn't know, of course, I was going to lose my job, but it was a wonderful thing that I got started because I just plowed on. And by the middle of March, I had the first draft done.
Why didn't you feel that you were immersed in your profession as a writer? Your first book had won a lot of acclaim and had been a National Book Award finalist also.
I think one of the things I'm beginning to realize is, especially because I've done far more stories than I have novels, of course, is that, you know, you might, at the end of this day, write a story that is grand, you know, wonderful, the greatest thing since Chekhov, since James Joyce. You know, and the world might tell you that. But tomorrow, Wednesday, you get up and you start another story. You can't take all of that acclaim and start writing. You know, you're starting, in a certain sense, from the bottom of the mountain again. You know? So I think one of the things I didn't allow myself to do is to, you know, paste all those wonderful notices about Lost in the City on the wall and look at them every day. You know, I put them away because that was lost in the city and I was going on to something else. So all the wonderful things can't help you write, get up tomorrow morning and write as well as you wrote today. Which is why a lot of people publish a lot of bad books, even after they publish wonderful books.
I'm talking with Edward P. Jones. His new novel is The Known World. Jones is also the author of a collection of short stories, Lost in the City. I want to take a break here, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Edward P. Jones. His new novel is The Known World. Jones' other writing includes Lost in the City, a collection of short stories. So over 10 years or so, you didn't take any notes. How did you hold on to all of these characters' stories and their backstory and their histories?
I don't know myself. I think that one of the things I was able to do is just living my life. I just went over stuff over and over again, all the chapters from beginning to the end.
It's so amazing to me you would deny yourself writing something down.
I think I felt, well, you know, you can't really say any of this stuff until you read all the books and everything, you know. It's, I think it was a sort of way of punishing myself, you know. You're not doing the reading, so you really can't get the stuff out of your head. And that's how I went, you know, just sort of a weird way of doing it. And I look at it now, you know. I was sitting here and before we started speaking, And I was reading the section about the cousin council, and I was thinking, no, it wasn't such a bad job, you know. And so I don't know. Maybe if I had taken notes and everything, maybe if I had gotten to it in 96 or 95, I wouldn't have what I have now, you know. So maybe all of that waiting and all that denial produced what I have right now.
You dedicated this novel to your mother and your brother. And of your mother, you write, who could have done so much more in a better world. What were your mother's aspirations and what held her back?
Well, I think what I know about her is that all she could handle was, you know, caring for her two children and going to work every day. My mother, she couldn't read or write. So her world, her sky didn't rise very high.
What was her background that she never learned to read or write?
Well, she was born in rural Virginia and raised in Virginia and parts of North Carolina and on a farm. And, of course, in those days, in the 20s and 30s, because she was born, I think, in something like 1916, you know, children were needed for the labor in the fields. And so, of course, education tended to take a way, way, way back seat. She did. She went, I think, for maybe one or two grades or something, but she never really learned to read and write.
I'm wondering what that was like.
I grew
like.
Up with her making X's on everything.
Uh huh.
Whenever she signed something.
So what was that like for you? I'm thinking of one of the short stories in your collection,
yeah,
in The Lost City. It's about a mother who's registering her daughter for kindergarten,
yeah,
and the
yes.
mother has to ask for help filling out the forms because she can't. She can't read. It's really yeah. poignant because you know that at some point the daughter is going to be ashamed of her mother. In
yeah.
fact, you say that
yeah.
in the first sentence, I think, of the story.
Yes, exactly. In first line, yes.
Yeah.
Long before I learned to be ashamed of my mother. And it's the only one that's, everything else in the story is in present tense. That's the only thing that's a past tense.
And this really is the first step towards the daughter moving
yeah.
towards that day that she'll be ashamed
yes,
of her mother.
Yes, exactly, exactly, yeah. That's the... There are 14 stories in Lost in the City, and that's the only one that's taken from part of my own life. I do remember my mother and I getting up and going to First Seton School, as a girl and her mother do in the story, and then we were told that's not where we were supposed to go, so we went to Walker Jones. All the other stuff about waiting for someone to help fill out a card, all of that is just my making fiction.
Well, do you remember that moment when you realized... Oh, I'm different. My mother can't read and write. That you were embarrassed.
Yeah. There aren't a lot of situations where I went to kindergarten in Catholic school, and there must have been some sort of letter telling the parents that you know, come pick them up at a certain time, because it maybe it was the first week or the second week. I came out after lunch, and there were a lot of kids. All the kids were in the playground, and then everybody disappeared, you know, and the kindergarten was closed. And I was sitting there, and my mother hadn't come to pick me up. And I think there must have been some letter saying, you know, when you're supposed to come, and she hadn't read the letter because she couldn't read it. And they put me in the first grade after that, so for a few months there, I'd gone from kindergarten to first grade. But another time I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, my brother is severely retarded. And they sent a letter to my mother. I remember we were living on New York Avenue, and I still have the letter to this day. And what was essentially is that the city government was saying that my brother, being feeble-minded, that's the phrase in there, that they was going to take him and put him in an institution. And my mother had to run around and find someone. And I can remember standing on those steps after the guy read it, and she just started crying.
Where was your father?
He sort of disappeared after my sister was born. So he was not really there. I think my mother died January 1, 75, and he died in March that year. And I was sort of happy that he and I had never really been close, because I couldn't have taken two deaths like that so close. He's buried in a Catholic cemetery in D.C., and up until about 20 years ago, he didn't have a headstone, and I don't know if he has one today, but I'm in no hurry to give him one.
What are you writing about now, or thinking about writing?
I'm writing a collection of stories, and I'm building, I'm taking, in a lot of cases, a minor character from a story in Lost in the City and building a story around that person. And the first story in Lost in the City is about a girl with pigeons, and I'm writing about the man who first gave her pigeons when he was an infant, was discovered hanging from a tree. And the story is about the woman who found him and about her husband.
How long have you been thinking about this?
A long time. As a matter of fact, when I sat down to do The Known World, I first started writing stories in 2001, because that's what I've been doing for a long time. It was hard to stop and think about something long-term like a novel.
Well, Edward P. Jones, it was really interesting and an honor to get inside your head for this time. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Edward P. Jones' book is The Known World. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.